This project is a book project, ostensibly, is Double Diaspora in Sephardic Literature from 1200 to 1600, which is kind of a broad sweep of time. So we're going to be moving very quickly, and I hope you can stay with me. I'm going to start by giving a little overview about, you know, what is Sephardic literature, in case you don't know about it, about this idea of double diaspora, beginning with the idea of diaspora, and then a little bit I'll talk about current critical thought about diasporas and diaspora theory, and then also more traditional thinking about the Jewish doctrine of galut, which is the original concept of diaspora in the Hebrew and Judaic context. And then I'll give you a few case studies for pre-1492 and post-1492 Sephardic literature and discuss how these case studies and how these writers give voice to a sort of diasporic mindset and a diasporic way of thinking in their literature and in the way that they write literature and they practice literature. I want to start by saying, what's Sephardic literature? Well, then you have to start by asking, what is Sepharad? Sepharad is a place. So who is Sephardic and what did they write? What is Sepharad? In the most basic sense, Sepharad is the Hebrew name for the Iberian Peninsula. That's the Iberian Peninsula with the Balearic Islands included. It's mentioned in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament, in Ovadia, sort of very much in passing, the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, referring to groups of Jews who are living in some place called Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. Now, we don't know. In the Bible, it's not clear that this is Spain. It was later adopted to mean, to indicate the Iberian Peninsula, but it's not clear from the Bible itself that it's supposed to be Spain. It's somewhere, it's been theorized, it's in Asia Minor, it's here, it's there. And the same goes for Ashkenaz, or Germany, or the western sphere of Jewish Europe. It's in the Bible, but it's not clear exactly where geographically it indicated, but both of these terms, Ashkenaz and Sepharad, have been adopted to indicate, you know, roughly the Rhine Valley and roughly the Iberian Peninsula. And in the case of the Iberian Peninsula, it's stuck. So in Jewish sources, Sepharad is always the Iberian Peninsula. If it's Roman Iberia, it's Sepharad. If it's Visigothic Iberia, it's Sepharad. If it's Al-Andalus Muslim Iberia, it's Sepharad. If it's Castilla y León, High Middle Ages, Sepharad. All of this, it's always Sepharad. And then after the Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492, Sepharad and the Sephardic culture goes on the road broadly, and the communities from Spain, of Jewish communities from Spain, are scattered throughout the Mediterranean basin and beyond, and towards the Americas also. I won't go into as much, but there's a pretty broad, generally throughout the Ottoman Empire and throughout the Moroccan Sultanate, and also throughout some of the countries of Western Europe, principally Italy, and to a lesser degree the Netherlands, and lesser degree France and Great Britain. So that's from a start, that's what I mean when I say Sepharad and Sephardic. So why a focus on Sephardic writers in a context of Hispanic literature? I'm trained as a Hispanist with some background in Arabic and Hebrew, principally Spanish literature, Castilian literature. Why am I focusing on Sephardic writers? What do I hope to achieve by this particular focus? One is that Sephardic literature has been kind of marginalized within Judaic studies, which tends to focus more broadly on U.S. Judaic literature, Israeli literature, European Jewish literature. Sephardic literature as a field of literary inquiry has been kind of like pretty well marginalized. It's highly marginalized within the context of Hispanic studies because most Hispanists just don't have the background in Judaic studies or in Hebrew it's not a national language. It's not, you know, there's no country of Sephardim that are producing a literature, so it hasn't enjoyed that kind of focus. So it's been kind of marginalized in Judaic studies, marginalized in Hispanic studies. There's a lot of work to be done yet. In popular Jewish culture, and especially in the U.S., the whole idea of Sephardic culture is very much in vogue these days, and there's a lot of interest in the popular music and ballad tradition of the Sephardim and the cookery of the Sephardim in various aspects of the culture of the Sephardim. And it's a good time to kind of introduce the literature of the Sephardim to both audiences of Hispanists and U.S. General audiences that are interested in Jewish culture generally and Latino culture generally. And there's a good overlap right there of sort of Jewish, Hispanic, international, Mediterranean. And it's also an interesting kind of complement to what people conceive as a Hispanic culture in general as being culture that's coming from Spain or from Latin America or perhaps from, you know, broadly speaking, U.S. as well. Because this is a sort of Hispanic culture that has been thriving throughout the Mediterranean for a few centuries, but is very little known. So it's a sort of Judaica exotica in that sense. You know, it's kind of an interesting overlay of Mediterranean, Hispanic, and Jewish culture. Most of the literature written by Sephardim historically has not been stories and poems, but most of it's rabbinical literature, ethical treatises, legal briefs, and that kind of thing, commentaries on the Bible. So the corpus that I'm showing you is a tiny little sliver of the overall corpus, just to give you a little perspective. So I talk about double diaspora in Sephardic literature. So we'll start briefly with what's diaspora. What's diaspora sort of in the Judaic context? What's diaspora in the larger sort of globalized context? And what do I mean by double diaspora? Diaspora, broadly writ, is a scattering or a dispersion of a population from an original homeland. And it was originally applied to Jewish history. Since then, it's been applied to cases of Armenian populations, Indian, Chinese, African. You know, there's been tremendous proliferation in social sciences, in history, and even in literary studies of discussion of different diasporas or different populations. So part of the project here is to bring the discussion of current diasporas together with the idea of Jewish diasporas, which have been sort of typically talked about separately. Yeah, sure.
It's obviously got the Greek root, right? But mm-hmm. was it actually coined in relation to Jewish history?
It was the word itself. No, the word itself was just means to scatter it like mm-hmm. seeds.
Okay.
But in that
use of the scattering
yes,
of the population,
it was then come to be understood as the scattering of the Jewish population,
right.
Yeah, and then later other populations. But as far as I know, within historical thinking, that was the first population to be called a diaspora.
Got it.
And historians here can jump in and correct me. In the Jewish tradition, the exile from, I'm going to call it Zion, to avoid the whole discussion of the political discussion of is it Israel, is it Palestine, is it Judea and Samaria, is it, you know, what is it? I'm going to call it Zion because in the sort of imaginary symbolic realm, it's Zion. So the Hebrew exile from Zion is called Galut, which means exile, basically. And it's very ideologically and prophetically tinged, right? It has like a very heavy prophetic overtone to it, meaning like this condition of statelessness and this condition of dispersion has a corrective, which is the coming of the Messiah, at which point all the Jews will regather in Zion. And it also pertains to a chosenness or a special relationship to God, right? So on one side it's negative because you're in suffering and exile. On the other sense, it's positive because you also enjoy this privileged relationship with God, the doctrine of chosenness, which in almost all branches of Judaism is still holds, except for Reconstructionism, which actually repudiated the doctrine of chosenness. So some traditional voices from history that talk about this Jewish idea of galut, this Jewish idea of exile, I have two examples, one from the 10th century, one from the 12th century, both of them originally from Spain. This first one is Chastai bin Shaprut, who was court physician to Abdurrahman III, the caliph in Cordova, very highly placed guy in the administration. He's writing a letter to the kingdom of Khazaria in Central Asia, which is a small kingdom that has converted to Judaism. So for the first time in known history since the dispersion of the Jews from Zion, you have a political Judaism, if you will, to borrow the term from current discussion. So he talks about, you know, how can an idea be expressed in fair words by those who have wandered? You know, how can we actually talk about a political existence? How can the Jews who don't have recent experience of a political reality talk about politics and talk about a Jewish country? You know, these are people that see their flags in the land no more. There's a loss of sovereignty that characterizes the experience, right? However, we're dwelling peacefully in the land of our sojourning, right? For our God has not forsaken us. So there's this idea that God is protecting you in your exile and allowing you to thrive. Ibn Shaprut is a you know, equivalent of a vice president, practically, or a cabinet member. So despite being a member of a minority culture and a member of a culture in dispersion, his society is doing okay because God is protecting them. I have another example here from Maimonides, a really well-known jurist and physician and rabbinical expert, born in Spain and then did most of his work in Morocco and then in Egypt. And he's writing here a letter to the Jews of Yemen, and this is a really famous letter of his. And he says, and this is just echoing traditional ideas about diaspora, God has made us unique by his laws and precepts. Right? So there's this chosenness, and it comes hand in hand with this conflictive statelessness. Therefore, all the nations instigated by envy and impiety rose up against us. Right? They envy us because we're special, and they rose up against us. However, they're not going to triumph because God is protecting us. Right? So it's this long, long, long historical trial. You're chosen on one hand to suffer, but you're also chosen to be redeemed eventually. And this is the sort of the driving idea behind Jewish history up until fairly recently, as I'll demonstrate. Modern historians also talk about galut in a sort of prophetic tone, right? It's suffering, but suffering with a special purpose, right? So Salo Baron, who is one of the foremost modern historiographers of the Jews, says, the Jew who on his part never conceded his inferiority felt that humiliation by unfriendly Gentiles was part of a complex of sufferings, right? That's the condition we're in, a complex of sufferings, galut. Okay, more recent quote from Raphael Patai, his big treatise on the Jewish mind, originally published in the 70s, reprinted in the 90s. The chronicle of powerlessness, passive endurance, is the galut, the exile. But it's also the record of Israel's enduring chosenness and a special relationship with God, right? So this idea of galut persists up until very, very recently in academic Judaic history. You know, these are modern academics who are supposed to be dispassionate. Nonetheless, this whole idea of galut still persists in the way they approach Jewish history. So recently, Jonathan Ray, who's a Sephardic historian, medieval historian at Georgetown, says, hey, wait a minute. We shouldn't be doing this anymore. We need to take a step back. There's a lot of other people who are talking about diasporas in a sort of more dispassionate way. Maybe it's time to break with the tradition of Jewish historiography and sort of take a look at what other historiographers and other social scientists and literature students are doing, literature scholars are doing about diaspora. Like, look, there's a problem with galut. He says, the approach that equates Jewish diaspora with galut privileges the idea of longing for an ancient and semi-mythic homeland over more concrete ties developed to the lands of more recent residents. Meaning, the diaspora of Jews historically is a multifarious and very complex phenomenon that takes place in many different places under many different types of conditions. It's not a monolithic experience, and it's time to start treating it in academics as a monolithic experience, as a very complex system of experiences. And it's remarkable to me that this only gets voiced in 2008. Like, nobody actually... There's a couple of glimmers before it and a couple of really important essays, but nobody comes out and says it so clearly, specifically in the case of the Sephardim, until 2008. He goes on and says, look, this mindset, the galut mindset that has dominated Jewish history, says, you know, Jews experience diaspora in much the same way as other societies. There is no prophetic nature to this diaspora. That's a narrative that's been constructed, but it doesn't necessarily structure the history itself. It structures the way the history has been perceived and communicated. And again, it seems like a very late date to be making this kind of realization, but that's how it's played out. I'm going to skip over a couple of these. In Spain, you also have scholars of Judaic studies saying very similar things, saying, you know, there's a certain exceptionalism that has predominated in the field that maybe it's time to give this another look. Maybe the Jewish experience is not completely unique. Maybe it has a lot to do with the cultural experience of the communities that are in diaspora. In the case of Spain here, Ángel Sanz Balillos, who's one of the foremost experts in Hebrew in Spain, or actually anywhere, he says, Hebrew literature from Christian Spain tends to be understood with an internal perspective as another stage of Hebrew literature, rather than from a true understanding of literary creation in the context of Spanish culture, the wider culture, where it took place. And he said this the day before yesterday, 2001. So this is a very late awakening in the fields of Judaic studies. So what does diaspora theory offer to people who want to study Jewish diaspora? It offers a more critical perspective. You're getting away from this sort of prophetic hangover in Judaic studies. It offers a focus on historical specificity, the actual historical specificities and realities of each case that you're studying. And it looks at diaspora as kind of a dynamic system, sort of a system of interlocking communities that are themselves dynamic and changing over time. And it looks at, sort of, it offers a self-referential, self-critical body of criticism. people who study the Indian diasporas or the African diasporas or the Chinese diasporas, by nature, are, as theorists, are more self-critical and more self-referential. There's more auto-criticism of the work that they're doing going on, and I think people working in Judaic studies can borrow from that and sort of turn the lens back on themselves and what they're doing. Excuse me. So I'm going to give you a couple of snapshots from diaspora theory, people who are theorizing diasporas of different populations, and say, okay, how can I use the ideas that they're using here? How are these going to be productive for reading Sephardic writers? Okay, how can they be a corrective to a galut mindset, a traditional approach mindset? Here's one. James Clifford, anthropologist, prominent anthropologist, wrote a very seminal essay about diasporas, 1994. He said, diasporas are transnational networks. They're not national. It's not a nationalist thing. It's a transnational network. They encode practices of accommodation with, as well as resistance to, host countries and their norms, right? So a population in diaspora is not isolated by any sense of the imagination. They're very imbued with the wider culture of where they live, but they're also in a dialogue, and a sort of, there's a tension between like the diasporic culture and the regional culture, right, that's constantly being articulated and changing all the time. And he points this out. Vijay Mishra, who wrote a book about theorizing the Indian diaspora, he says, he's commenting on the Jewish diaspora because he's giving an overview of diaspora theory, so he starts with the Jewish case, and this is really interesting. He says, Jewish migration was largely from one in-between place to another and not from Palestine to a new land. So historically, the experience is not Zion to somewhere else, but somewhere else to somewhere else, somewhere else to somewhere else, and Zion is the symbolic reference point, right? You're thinking about Zion, turning towards Zion, but you're going here and you're going there and you're living in one place for a long time. Their own diasporic episteme was located squarely in the realm of the hybrid, right? So your way you experience and the way you articulate the experience of diaspora is all about being in between point B and point C. Hello? Okay.
Authenticate yourself.
Yeah, authenticate. Okay, I think you get... Oh, diasporic subjectivity is complex, right? So this is Kachuk Talolian, who's a professor at Wesleyan. He's a literature professor, and he's written extensively on diaspora. In fact, he wrote this one really important, I suppose it's important, treatise on diaspora in Armenian, and it hasn't been translated into any other language. And he's from an Armenian family that left Armenia at the end of the 16th century. And he's still writing academic treatises in Armenia, you know, in the U.S., coming from France, to give you a sample of a different type
Anatole
of
diaspora. Pynchon as well.
What's that?
Anatole Thomas Pynchon as well.
Anatole Thomas Pynchon. You brought Anatole Thomas Pynchon also? Oh, cool. So you have something in common. Yeah. And he talks about the structures of identity are complex. It's very complex. It's not a monolithic thing. It's always complex in every case. You always have to look at the complexity. Be sensitive to the complexity. Okay. Why double diaspora? Double diaspora, I didn't invent this idea. This idea has been applied to a couple of other diasporic moments. I think it's useful in terms of talking about Sephardic diaspora because when people talk about Sephardic literature, they generally talk about post-1492. And then pre-1492 tends to be called Hispano-Jewish or Judeo, I don't know, Hispano-Hebrew, or it's peninsular, but it's not talked about together. That there's this tremendous rupture in 1492, and it's, if Sephardic culture gets born after 1492... and I'd like to bring together in literary study, which is also sort of very a minority field in Sephardic studies, bring together these two halves, pre-1492 and post-1492. And the double diaspora framework allows you to do that because you can talk about diaspora, you know, the diaspora experience in Spain, and then there's another diaspora that occurs out of Spain, another layer of kind of symbolic references and another layer of thinking about being in diaspora that gets added on top of your diaspora experience when you're living in Spain. Now you have sort of two diasporic dynamics. So I do this to sort of bring together 1492 and post-1492. I do this to sort of establish a voice for literary studies in this field that's dominated pretty much by historians working on the Ottoman period. And also to bring together medieval texts with that are not often studied together with texts from the 16th and 17th centuries. So I'm going to try to touch on four case studies. I'll probably get to two or three. Two of them are pre-1492, and two of them are post-1492. So two of them are coming from Castile in the 13th century, and the last two are coming from Turkey in the 16th century. And these are both the post-1492 examples are both from families who, both from writers who were born either in Spain or born, you know, in Turkey very shortly after the expulsion. I think actually both of these people were born. No, both of these were born in Spain. Okay, so the first case study, what brings these all together? In both cases, I'm looking at how these writers, both in Spain and outside of Spain, are engaging with the culture of the host land, be it Spain or be it Turkey. I'm looking at what's the meaning of the use of a diasporic classical literary language, while at the same time you're adopting sort of themes from popular literature of the land where you live, right? So you're using like ideas from Castilian literature, from French literature, from European literature, Western European literature, but you're writing them in Hebrew. So what does that mean when you actually get down to the level of the text? And you can see in many cases that there's a clear affiliation with Romance vernacular literature, right? They're pulling out themes and ideas and ways of writing literature that were current in Spain, current in Catalonia, current in France, and using them in Hebrew. And there's that tension between Hebrew and Judaic tradition and popular Romance tradition. So the case of Jacob ben Elazar, this is a man who lived in 13th century Castile, Toledo. Toledo was a city that was conquered by the Christians in 1085, but it was still very much a multicultural society in 1220. So this was a place where people were fluent in Arabic, read Arabic books, they read Latin books, they wrote Hebrew books if they were Jewish, they read Hebrew books if they were Jewish. It was a very multilingual literary scene. I'm taking one example of this book that he wrote. He wrote a collection of stories called The Book of Stories, or alternately Love Stories. Some of them are love stories, some of them are other things. I'm taking the example of a love story that looks very much like a French romance in some aspects, particularly in the way that we're talking about love and how the lovers behave and how they talk to each other and the sort of imagined, you know, doctrine of love, of courtly love, in Hebrew. Which normally when you're seeing Hebrew, you don't see these things in Hebrew. You see the kind of courtly love that is more common to Arabic literature, or you see sort of set pieces that are taken out of the Song of Songs, you know, the way you talk about love. But this is an example of a rarer example of a Hebrew author in the 13th century sort of adopting notions from French romance way before it happens in Castilian, but happening in Spain. This is a book that's very difficult to find. The modern edition is almost completely unknown, and it's physically very difficult to get your hands on. There's like one copy of it in the whole interlibrary loan system, and it's in Germany somewhere. So it's very hard. This is like, how marginalized is this literature? It's pretty well marginalized. You can't even lay your hands on a copy. So in some senses, this story, Sahar and Kima, a boy named Sahar and a girl named Kima, it looks kind of like a French romance in Hebrew clothing. And we know that French romance were widely circulated in the Iberian Peninsula at this time. They just haven't produced any in Castilian at this point. They've been reading them in French and sort of, you know, talking about them in Castilian. So we see the adaptations of some of the conventions of the romance, but also a sort of diasporization of the values of romance. And I'm going to explain what I mean. Meaning, the sort of some of the values of the Jewish community are then sort of mapped onto the structures of the French romance, right? And I'll demonstrate what I mean. Okay, the idea of courtly romance. Some of the ways that the lovers talk to each other and speak to each other and the way they talk about love looks like it's straight out of a French romance. And there's details that differentiate it from an Arab romance or a Persian romance, which you also have, but some of the conventions are different. So here's a citation. Sahar, he laid eyes upon her and was struck with her beauty. Okay, that's a universal. He bowed and kissed her hand, as is the habit of all gallants with their beloveds. And they kissed from afar, as is the custom among true lovers. So you have two things going on here. One of them is the kissing of the hand, which you don't see anywhere in Hebrew ever, as far as I know. And I've asked people, and I don't see this in Hebrew. Nobody kisses anybody's hand. That's straight out of France. Oh, those French, their customs, yes. And then, as is the custom among true lovers, and this is one reference, but there's a whole series of references of the sort of the practice of true lovers, the doctrine of true lovers, the rules of behavior. And this is straight up courtly love, 12th century. And you don't see this discussion of the way a true lover should behave in the Hebrew sources. They just describe what's going on, but they don't have this meta discussion of, like, there's this known doctrine of love that you're supposed to then go out and carry out in your actions. This is straight up from Romance literature, and it's coming bubbling up through in this Hebrew composition. And this isn't common. This isn't happening all over the place. This is a sort of select example, but it shows you that this is also happening. Sahar and Kima. Okay, a little more. The lady Kima speaks forth on the value of chaste love. She has like a whole discourse on how chaste love is more elevated and more spiritual and this and that and so on and so forth. And it's all this stuff that's coming straight from the troubadours. And it's not that you don't see these values expressed in Hebrew poetry elsewhere, except in other Hebrew poets that are also imitating troubadours. And all of this business prefigures such examples in Castilian by about 100 years. You don't have compositions in Spanish, in Castilian, yet espousing these kinds of values until much later. They're done in Provençal, or they're done in Galician Portuguese, or they're imported in Italian, but you don't see it being produced. So it's being produced, it's kind of a harbinger of what's going to come out of Castile 100 years later, but it's happening in Hebrew. Okay, so what do I mean about diasporization of romance? So in chivalric romance, you know, it's all about feats of arms in the service of love, right? The knight in shining armor goes out and defeats somebody or something or saves somebody all in the name of his beloved, right, to serve the lady. In the Sephardic romance, it's feats of rhetoric, right? Sahar goes to court and delivers some brilliant oratory which wins over, you know, the ministers at court, right? That's his feat that he does in the service of his lady. It's you're substituting the sort of Sephardic values for the wider culture values, right? In the Sephardic case, there are no Sephardic knights. They don't go to war. But what do they do? How do you excel if you're a man in Jewish culture in Spain in the 13th century? You go to court and you show your brilliance at court. And you become a Hasdai bin Shapru. Right? So we substitute those values for the values of the chivalric romance, and it's a very diasporic turn right here. Right? You're borrowing the national literature and substituting kind of your own community's values for it. So you're in dialogue with the national literature, with the national culture, but you're putting your own stamp on it at the same time. And you're writing in Hebrew, right? So ostensibly you're writing for people who will understand Hebrew. Okay. So that's one example. I'm going to skip ahead because I'm talking too much. I'm going to skip ahead to a post-1492 example and show you what I mean by knitting it all together. Okay. Here's a post-1492 example. This is a really interesting book, and Michael here knows all about this book. He wrote a really good essay on it. It's Solomon Ibn Verga was a man who was born in Spain, then moved to Portugal after 1492, and then moved to Naples after 1497 when the Jews were expelled from Portugal, and then eventually ended up in Turkey. So he's this kind of international man of mystery, intellectual. He writes this interesting book that is a sort of compilation of histories and persecutions and expulsions of Jews around the European and Mediterranean world, alternating back and forth between Rome and the Middle Ages, or Rome and the current epoch. All right? Now, the way I kind of try to understand what he's doing here is he's sort of a Jewish humanist in the sense that he's looking back to antiquity, and often he's borrowing from Latin and Greek sources from antiquity, some of which have been translated into Hebrew that he then uses, but he was probably knew Latin from having lived as a converted Jew in Portugal and in Naples, so he's had sort of a Christian education also. But he sort of alternates back between great deeds of Rome and great feats of imperial Rome and great feats of current monarchs and of current Jewish communities. But in the case of a Christian humanist who would be, say, for example, a court historian working for Fernando and Isabel, the Catholic monarchs, at the end of the 1400s, beginning of the 1500s, they would say, we're looking back to Rome to justify the greatness of the current regime, right? We're looking for precedents of, you know, political greatness or rhetorical greatness in Rome, right? And establishing kind of like a genetic political line from Rome to the current regime in Spain, right? And this is sort of a humanist historian tactic that's very common. You see it over and over again. Now, the diasporic turn here with Ibn Verga is what he does a similar thing structurally. Again, you're sort of borrowing the structures. You're turning towards antiquity, right? But you're substituting the values of the Sephardic community, of the diasporic community that isn't sovereign, right? That depends on king. That depends on a king. It doesn't have its own king, right? So I'll give you a few examples for what happened. So instead of, for example, in the if you're reading Alfonso de Palencia or something, or some Spanish humanist historian, he will say things like, you know, he'll look back at, you know, great feat of some emperor and say, oh, this is wonderful, blah, 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 blah. And our king does the same thing because he does such and such and such, so he draws this connection. So Ibn Verga does something similar, but he does it with persecutions and expulsions and sort of like, how did the Jews deal with these like difficult moments? Not how did they have these terrific victories, this sort of like, how did they suffer elegantly rather than how did they win elegantly or eloquently? Right, so he sort of turns it on its head. It's a Hebrew text, but it's also peppered with Castilian words, and this is another sort of diasporic moment. So it's a Hebrew text, which makes you think, okay, it's going out towards Jewish communities in Turkey and Italy and other countries that don't necessarily, they're not exclusively Sephardic communities. They don't all know Spanish, right? But nonetheless, he's using Spanish as a sort of a marker of prestige, because at this moment, this Jewish Spain was considered a very prestigious culture broadly throughout the Mediterranean, and he's sort of like borrowing this authority that Spanish and Spanish culture has. Even though he's been expelled from Spain, he's still borrowing from the prestige of the vernacular culture. Right, so he peppers his Hebrew text with Spanish words that he doesn't translate. He just leaves them transliterated, you know, into Hebrew letters, so that everyone knows if you know Spanish, you understand it. If you don't know Spanish, you at least know, like, oh, it's sort of like peppering your conversation with French words if you're trying to affect, you know, sort of prestige. So at the same, there's this tremendous alienation from the homeland or the host land, but at the same time, it's also he's leaning on it for its prestige. So it's again, it's a very complex kind of dynamic, and it keeps changing over time. Anyway. So this is very characteristic of the tension and the dynamism and the complexity that modern diaspora theoreticians talk about, that Tololian talked about, for example. Okay, I'll give you an example or two from what I mean. Oh yeah, Jewish humanist history. So Ibn Verga is sort of a humanist historian, right? Robert Tate, who's talked about humanism in Spain, he says, humanistic subordination of history to ars oratoria, right? So it's all about great moments in oratory, great moments in rhetoric, right? So he says, Ibn Verga says, no, it's all about persecutions of Rome as a model for current persecutions and great acts of either oratory or rhetoric or even Kabbalistic performances, right, which is substitute for oratory. So instead of going back and talking about Cicero, you'll go back and talk about some great Kabbalist. I'm going to skip over this. I'll give you an example here. There's two really terrific, very evocative examples from Ibn Verga. So he's talking about a particular blood libel accusation that happened in Jerez, near Sevilla, in southern Spain. And, you know, there's a Jewish member of the community who gets framed for the murder of a murder of a man in the community. When in reality, there were these three friars from one of the local communities who committed the murder. So now they're explaining how the malfeasance of the friars becomes exposed. And there's this Rabbi Yehuda, right? He comes to the scene and he pronounces the holy name, right? For he was also a Kabbalist. So he pronounces some secret name of God. And the Duke, who he's talking to, who's presiding over this case, takes out a parchment that he had. And the rabbi says, okay, you know, on this parchment, I'm going to call forth the truth of what happened. And this is really fascinating. I don't know of any other examples in any literature that yield this. The Duke takes out the parchment and found a drawing of four groups of friars, right? So he has a parchment that he's folded into four sheets. It's like a comic strip, right? So it says, the Duke took out the parchment and found a drawing of four groups of friars. On the one side, there were three friars digging up Gentile graves and taking out a body. On the second square were three friars carrying the body, and because it was heavy, one of them had wrapped his belt, called a cordón de fraile, and these are one of these words that he just sticks in there in Castilian, around it, right? When the Duke saw this marvel, this magic Kabbalistic comic strip that's sort of like a crystal ball, he was astonished and fell on his face, bending his knee, right? Sent the parchment with the pictures to the king. Right away, the Duke sent for the friars who denied the deed. He then took out the parchment, whereupon they confessed to him, astounded. You know, he pulls out the magic comic strip, and they're like, okay, you got me. The Duke asked them about the business with the cordon, and they said that it had indeed happened thus. Right? And again, he repeats cordon in Spanish there, to sort of lean on the prestige of the dialect. Right? there's an awful lot going on there. One of the things that's most astounding about this is the magic comic strip, which I don't know about. I haven't seen this anywhere in any other source anywhere, this motif. I don't know, maybe you have.
It's in Miracles of the Virgin in the late medieval French stuff.
Oh, I'm so glad. That's perfect.
Yeah,
that's perfect.
The time is just about
that's
right.
Perfect.
Is it like 1470 or 1480?
Oh, great. I'm going to have to dig that up, because the editor of this text didn't gloss it at all, didn't give any explanation, but that's perfect. That only strengthens my point. That's awesome. Okay, I'll give you one more example from Ibn Verga, and then we'll wrap it up. Here's another feat of Kabbalism. I guess in a sense it's a miracle tale, but it's being kind of appropriated in a humanist context. Excuse me. It's another blood libel accusation. And there's this boy who's murdered. And again, a Kabbalist is called to the scene. It's like CSI. The Kabbalist comes, he's the forensic expert, and he's going to explain how it all happened. So I have heard in Sefarad, and he's here reporting an oral source for this tale, some people spread the accusation that they found a dead boy in the house of a Jew. And this happens over and over again. He gives a whole series of these blood libel accusations. Don Solomon Halevi, who was a sage and a Kabbalist, put the one true name under the tongue of the boy. So there's the murdered boy. The Kabbalist comes and, again, performs a little hocus pocus. And he writes down one of the secret names of God on a parchment and puts it under the tongue of the boy. When the boy awoke, hello, comes back from the dead, wakes up and said, "This is who murders me," and then goes back to sleep. I have not seen this written, but that was how I heard it. So another example of these feats. These are, instead of these great feats of oratory or these great feats of arms that are then used to sort of legitimate the current situation, there's the great feats of rhetoric or great feats of Kabbalism that are then used to sort of legitimate the current situation. And he also refers back to great feats of oratory and great feats of religiosity in the antiquity. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what some of the strategies that Ibn Verga is deploying here, why they're diasporic and why they're doubly diasporic, right? Because you have now this idea of Spain as sort of the homeland, the lost homeland that he keeps turning and returning to. And that's what Kaçık Talulyan, the Armenian theorist, who also writes about Pynchon, says, it's about turning and returning, not returning, but turning again to the symbolic homeland, more than actually talking to return, because they don't actually talk about going back, except in sort of very broad prophetic scripts. So Ibn Verga, one of his texts is he often puts the truth, or the truth of a situation, or the defense of the Jewish position in the mouth of a Christian character, right? So he has this discussion here between Alfonso V of Aragon and the rector of the University of Paris, Johannes Versorius. And he said, Ibn Verga says, "I have this discussion that I adapted from a Latin chronicle, although the modern editors have not been able to identify the source of this discussion from any Latin chronicle, so he probably made it up. But he says, basically, he has the rector of the University of Paris defending the Jews and saying, look, you shouldn't pressure these people to convert. They're not going to do it. And here's what he says. This is a great snippet. And then we'll wrap it up. He says, Versorius says, "What good will it do our Lord, our King, when we spill holy water upon the Jews and call them by our names, Pedro or Pablo? They continue to observe their law like Akiva and Tarfon, two rabbis from the Talmud. Fear not, their conversion will only serve to let them grow haughty against true Christians, for they now pass for Christian. They no longer give the royal taxes they used to when they were Jews." It's a great thumbnail explanation of the problem. "Understand, our Lord, and do not doubt that Judaism is one of the sicknesses for which there is no cure." It's really interesting because he's saying in a positive sense here. He's saying, like, to their benefit, this is a sickness for which there is no cure. So he's doing kind of a double consciousness thing where he's filtering his own perception of the Jewish situation through the perceived reportage of what a Christian character would explain it. So he's, again, he's saying, I borrow this from a Latin chronicle, right? So he's like resting on the prestige of Christian tradition from Spain, but at the same time deploying it in his own way, which is characteristic of this diasporic writer, a doubly diasporic writer. Okay. That I'm not gonna do this last piece. So that basically sums it up for me. Those are the examples, and the idea is constantly that you have a diasporic community that has sort of two, after 1492, two symbolic centers. One of them in Zion, and one of them in Sefarad. And I don't even call it Spain because it is Sefarad, because the community is Sephardic. And if you want to try to read the literature and get away from the idea of, you know, okay, a diaspora community is constantly looking towards Zion, period, you have to go beyond that and look at the historical specificity at the moment, look at the culture at the moment in which they're living, and then look at the ways in which the current culture of the times is either at odds or is allied with the Jewish strands of culture which are coming either from the Bible or from Jewish traditions that, you know, are coming from outside of Spain or from outside of the secondary homeland. And it's the tension between the two layers of diaspora, and I think I'll close with Jonathan Boyarin's apocryphal statement about double diaspora. He says you have to think about two or more layers of diasporic imagination that echo back and forth between each other, and to try to get at sort of the more complex nature of it. So that's the project, and thank you for listening and for bearing with me.